Well, why don't we get started?
Sure.
So I know it's a couple minutes before, but this is the Teaching Science Fiction panel. The science fiction for today is undergraduate. I'm Lee Grossman. I teach at the University of Connecticut, writer, editor. Most recently, the compiler of what I think is the largest science fiction anthology ever, the brand new textbook, A Sense of Wonder for Teaching Science Fiction. So if other panels will introduce themselves, please.
Okay, so I'm Joan Slonczewski. I've taught microbiology for 20 years at Kenyon College, and I also have a NSF-funded research program. My students publish cutting-edge work on drug-resistant bacteria, and in addition to authoring the microbiology textbook, Microbiology and Evolving Science, my latest novel coming up is The Highest Frontier, which is basically a college out in space. And if you're an educator, you'll love this book because, you know, it's like it's a send-up of everything that goes on in a liberal arts college. It's like anything I've wanted to say for 20 years. So it'll be a stitch. So that's coming out the second week of September, The Highest Frontier.
Cool. My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm an associate professor of English at St. John's University, and I teach courses there in fantasy and science fiction, among others. My first novel came out 2 years ago, actually, and my second and third are being shopped as we speak. I'm also co-editing an anthology on speculative fiction and politics with some of the people here, some of the writers, participating writers here. And the last thing is that I run a show online called Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans, which is about interviews a number of fantasy and science fiction authors, including a lot of Hugo and Nebula Award winners. If you want to win a Hugo and Nebula, you just come on with us. It has nothing to do with whether you're good before that. It just somehow you show up on our show and you do well. That's our story. We're sticking to it. But you can find out about that at speculatesf.com.
And I'm Michael Sisko. I teach. I'm an assistant professor of English at CUNY Hostos. That's a community college in South Bronx. So my students are coming from New York City Public High School for the most part. But we are a CUNY school. And I've taught, we only teach at the sophomore level, but I've taught both freshman and sophomore level, principally supernatural classes, which are things that straddle the line between science fiction. But we do have the elective course manager for the English department. We do have a standard sort of boilerplate science fiction formatted sophomore level class, survey class, in addition to teaching freshman level stuff. And I'm also a novelist. I've published 6 novels. The Divinity Student, which won the International Horror Writers Guild Award for Best First Novel in 1999, and numerous others, and have been in anthologies and whatnot. And I've been coming to read for a long time. So that's an education in science fiction. So I'm done.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I found in sort of doing the research that involved to finally sell this thing to a publisher was I found about 450 different science fiction courses offered in North America. I'm sure there are many more. These are just the ones I could find. And I was pretty astonished by the variety of them. You know, and these are just the science fiction courses, not the courses that happen to use a few things, but many of them were literature courses like the ones I teach at UConn. Many of them were pure science courses, biology courses, physics courses, computer courses, a lot of philosophy courses, a lot of women's studies courses, your courses on utopias and dystopias, huge amount of political science courses, you know, the Cold War through science fiction, a lot of particularly Eastern European language courses, and some outliers. There was at least one nursing course. The professor from IAC actually had written an essay for me on death and dying in science fiction. There was at least one law course that used law and science fiction there. So I think just to kind of throw things out, you know, some of the variety of stuff that you've come to and in the courses, how you've used it in different courses.
Sure. Well, the course I've taught at Kenyon for 15 years now is called Biology in Science Fiction. And I'll never forget the first year I taught it because 90 kids signed up. It's the way to get, they can get their science. The idea, they're always arts kids. And the idea that they could get their science requirement by taking science fiction and biology and science fiction, that was a hoot for them. And of course, the English department was aghast that I was doing this. That was the best part of it. But, so like the top 10 biology things that I wish every citizen would know and understand, just as a citizen. And if I figure if you could get some of these, and at the same time to get them and just have an appreciation for science in the context of society. And the three main themes are evolution, ecology, and genetics. So for each of those themes, I would pair books. So for evolution, the two books I pair are The Time Machine and Kurt Vonnegut's Galapagos. And by the way, Galapagos, if there is one book I wish you'd go and read for teaching, Kurt Vonnegut, I think that Galapagos is his best novel and certainly most underrated Rob Vonnegut novel. Galapagos is the equivalent of a textbook in evolution. So it's also a direct response to The Time Machine. So the literary kids really love that because they see how The Time Machine is called upon by the Vonnegut novel in a very direct way. So I can teach all kinds of evolution through that. The next two, for ecology, I pair Herbert's Dune with Adorned Ocean, my book about the ocean planet. And of course, I know that that's a direct response to Dune. And so like, I have the sea swallowers, which are really, the equivalent of the worms in the same word. I mean, everything. So, and in both of those are ecology books about ecologies and perturbing ecologies, and they play off each other. And so the students learn how ecosystems work, perturbation of ecosystems, and those work really well. And the third thing is for genetics and molecular biology, I pair Jurassic Park. You can't do without Jurassic Park. You have to have Jurassic Park. So I pair Jurassic Park with Brain Plague. Okay. And that's a less obvious pairing, but it works because they're both at the molecular level. And by that point, it's too late to drop the course.
They start reading your books.
So, they actually start to see the atoms there, and it's too late. You're in it now. You've got to take the exam. So that works pretty well.
I think I'm interested in this because I think had there been such a science fiction course when I was going to the University of Connecticut as an undergraduate, I would have been in there in a shot, as opposed to biology for non-majors, which was me. In my case, the course that I've taught for years at St. John's is kind of an introductory survey, and as far as I know, is the only science fiction or fantasy course that was offered at St. John's since I've been there, which is almost 10 years now. And I finally got them to split it, so I'm actually able to teach science fiction in the fall and fantasy in the spring, which is a little victory that I'm proud about, because it gives me an opportunity to sort of develop that much more. But my goal in teaching these courses for my students is to appeal to the two groups that generally take it, and the two groups generally are huge science fiction fans who will tell me in detail their frustration that I haven't taught X number of Doctor Who episodes, and I have that group. And then I have another group of people who have taken it because they've seen fiction and science and elective and night course all in the same sentence, and they think this is a combination made for me. And for that latter group of students, part of what I'm trying to do is, for the first group, I'm trying to show them that I take the subject as seriously as they do. For the second group, I'm trying to teach them that they ought to take that subject seriously in the first place. And so there is more to the science fiction world than what you'll see on movie screens and things like that. In fact, a lot of the books that I teach tend to have disastrous movies made of them. So I feel good if I get out of the course, and they email me later on and say, "Doctor Wilson, you were right. I saw iRobot. It's nothing like what Asimov said." And da 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 da. I said, "Yes, go forth. Please do more of that. Tell your friends." So I find myself sort of serving those disparate groups. And the nice thing about that for me is that there is kind of, I think, a coming together at the end of those two groups, where the group that was really into science fiction doesn't feel quite as isolated by that enjoyment by the time we get to the end of the course, not just because other students who didn't like it have come to like the work, but also because I took it seriously as an academic who stands up at the front of the room and does not dismiss them. The second group, the ones who weren't really into it, end up finding that this work is stuff that should be taken seriously, and they blend nicely into being, maybe they're not hardcore fans by the time that they're done, but they're certainly more than they were when they came in. And so I often find that in the process of teaching books, books that I pair together. Books, this is fantasy, not science fiction, but books like Beowulf and Grendel, for example, that I'm capturing a lot of those two groups and combining them in ways that they might not have had had they not taken the course. So those are my basic aims when I'm teaching.
Well, for the most part, when I'm teaching more or less horror, I'm teaching it to freshmen. And I'm teaching typically to freshmen who've done a semester of comp, and this is the second half of their freshman year of English. So this is basically intro to lit. So my task is to fascinate them, if I can. Mm-hmm. Can I fascinate them with something? And because it's Hostos, because we have, it's largely a Dominican school, the community it serves is principally Dominicans and African Americans, with a significant influx of immigrants from largely Africa. And so they're going to get a lot of African American lit. There's a lot of that taught at the school. So I don't feel the need to do that. And in a way, it's a little bit, I have a slight misgiving about the idea that the only issue they can talk about is race. Mm-hmm. Well, if do you talk about race? Yeah, of course, duh. But only that, well, wait a minute, that's fishy too. Mm-hmm. So, I'm trying to get, it took me a while to find a theme for the class, something, a through line that I could use to unify a fairly diverse survey of work, because you have to cover, you have to have a play, you have to have poetry. All right, so how do I do that? And forbidden knowledge was the theme that I thought would work. And it's one that goes, branches into sci-fi to a considerable extent. So I mean, Frankenstein is one of the first books we do. And that one sits very neatly in the divide between sci-fi and horror. It's, I start with Faust. I would start with Genesis, but I feel it might be a little, the ground might be a little tender with that. But still, there
you sure would at St. John's.
There
sure.
is. If you start with Genesis, or at least, well, not the whole thing, obviously, but the passage involving the snake. There it is, forbidden knowledge, bang, very foundational text. And then from there, what I'm trying to do is get them to see, here's a book from thousands of years ago, here's a book from hundreds of years ago, here's a book from 50 years ago, same idea.
Yeah.
Same idea, same idea, same idea. It changes and alters, and it lives, it has a life, it has a history. It's not just about cookie cutter thinking, but it's about getting them to see literature in terms, not reduced to ideas, but to see how ideas can unify. Mm-hmm. So that, it's not a genre just because some people arbitrarily label this horror and that sci-fi, but because there are ideas that unify certain things and bring them together. And when they can link, so I'll have them do a paper and say, okay, what does Frankenstein have in common with Haunting of Hill House? Then someone will say, loneliness. Creature is isolated. Eleanor Vance, I keep getting mixed up because they changed it in the movie. Eleanor Vance is isolated and alone, and it's how they detach from society. It's like, yeah, see? It works, right? That's what my approach is, to use this subject matter, which in some ways is nice and neutral. Everyone has ghost stories. Everyone has, every tradition has its way of dealing with this. This is just one way. And so we can bring them in that way. And then I'm hoping they can take these skills on to subsequent English courses, so other humanities courses to find common ideas.
That's kind of a thread that all of you alluded to. That's one of the things that I always love about teaching, and I'd kind of like to get your thoughts. I mean, the courses I teach, part of the joy of teaching science fiction and fantasy at UConn is their upper-level literature courses that tend to draw across all majors.
Yeah.
And they do it in a very uneven way. So it's nice that it's not the same English majors in the same courses with all the people they've been in the other course and they've already had all the discussions.
Sure.
They're having those discussions with people who've read completely different things and read these works in completely different ways and spot different things because the biologists have come out of different experiences and will see different things in the stories. It can also, it means the classes are never the same even when they use the same readings. I had one year in the fantasy class where I had four voice majors in the class, and they spotted completely different things than everybody else in the stories. The whole class wound up pivoting on the idea of music and fantasy, and it made for completely different discussions. That was fascinating. I think I learned more from teaching that class than anything.
Yes, that is certainly true. The class that I teach, there are no science majors in it, but there will be majors in arts, history, philosophy, and some of these students know a lot more history and philosophy than I do, and so they can inform the class as to those dimensions of the work. I also wanted to mention, you mentioned teaching Genesis. I think that teaching Galapagos with Genesis is enormously fruitful, because Galapagos is a dialogue with Genesis, and it has a rhythm of prose that echoes the Bible, and it presents a way of understanding both the Bible and science at the same time as equally valid, but without throwing out the science. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that is something I think that's enormously rewarding.
One of the things I think that's interesting that I find every semester when I teach this course is how different, sort of pivoting off what you said a little bit about how the character of the students, you know, their backgrounds, et cetera, changes literally what the course is about in a way. I think my students are often surprised about how philosophical the course often gets. I think they expect, you know, whiz-bang, shoot-'em-up type things, and when they see that there is a enormous variety, which may include some whiz-bang, but includes a lot more sort of thoughtful consideration of the nature of life itself in some cases, for example, they are often surprised by that. And I think depending on the makeup of the course, students will respond more or less positively, but will always respond in some way to that fact. So I often find myself towards the end of the semester, I often have a couple of texts that I try to rotate around, especially for the last couple of slots in the course. And the responses that I've gotten to them have been interesting. I've tried Tales of Perks the Pilot. I've tried James Patrick Kelly's Burn. I've tried other sort of things in that general vein. I've tried somewhat harder sci-fi, somewhat softer sci-fi, and I'm never entirely able to tell until we actually get to that point what the response is going to be. In those two particular cases, Burn did not really go over very well for them. That may be because they went over, it came right after the number one text for them, which is Ender's Game, which they just absolutely adore. They would do Ender's Game until the cows came home. They could do a whole course on Ender's Game. It may have something to do with that, or it may just have been a little bit too much to throw at them. That's possible, too. I've had Tales of Perks the Pilot sometimes works well, sometimes doesn't. And so it's always interesting to see how it does and doesn't work, and whether I'm able to sort of tie that into how I teach the course going forward in terms of what texts I offer and how I choose to organize them and put them together. But I find the sort of common element is always whether or not they're responding to the philosophical content of these works and not simply the sort of cool whiz-bang science moments that they might have expected coming in, especially for that group that I told you that doesn't really know what the big deal is about this stuff. They are often the most surprised about the philosophical underpinning of a lot of the work that we do.
Similar with horror, in that a lot of them come in expecting pretty flimsy stuff for their acquaintance with horror. Like a lot of people, frankly, it's a little bit dismissive. There's maybe good reason for that. I don't think Twilight's very good. But, it's smart.
Twilight's smart.
Surprise, it's not because of that, because I'm not. But anyway, so, but, you know, when you go back to Faust, when you're able to go back to Shakespeare, when you are able to bring in someone like Shirley Jackson, who's really an extraordinary writer, and he's, oh, okay, yes, this does have a certain, this has heft. There's stuff here.
Yeah.
It's not just boo. There's a lot more to it. And the classes always bring something. This last class I had, the most recent one, back in the corner, he's from Egypt. He's Coptic. She's from Bangladesh. We got one Korean, two Koreans, and a Chinese woman back there. Bulk of the rest of the class, the Dominican, except for the two Jamaicans. We got those. So you have people from a whole variety of different backgrounds, and they all understand these things in slightly different ways. You know, if you're Muslim, your understanding of Genesis is inflected in a way that is not for someone, you know, for a Catholic.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not trying to get them at each other's throats or anything, but, well, there's no but like actually I do.
But I do.
But the point is, you know, avoid the throat lunge, but actually get them talking, you know, sort of, and, you know, not to threaten anybody, but to get people discussing ideas and to show how these texts are being told. And their backgrounds bring a great deal, and certain things they lock onto that I wouldn't have expected. Like, he has to do that to save face. Ah, okay, there's a concept of face. This is, and then everyone benefit. There's something else that I was going to forget. Why don't you give me time and I'll get it back?
Some works work way better than I expect. The one that I keep trying to use that sometimes works, sometimes doesn't, and you know what I'm doing, non-science fiction course as well, as David Brin's Star Tide Rising, which I love, and it's a beautiful book that requires you to have a good working knowledge of both physics and poetry. And some of them do and some of them don't. And some of them, they just get it all.
People don't like it?
Well, there are some people are overwhelmed, right? You know, if they're new to it, it's just, some of them absolutely love it and blow through it, and some of them just too much. I find certainly in the literature course, I use science fiction to go back to a lot of other things that they don't grasp from their other literature courses.
Yeah.
The idea of how fandom works and how writers work and how you get a whole lot better idea from being at a con of Shakespeare and Kit Marlowe sitting around in the bars kicking around ideas than you ever do from the kind of Norton anthology idea of, these were great writers touched by the gods, they sat and created literature. And, if I'm teaching Chip Delaney, the ideas of language in Babel 17 are a lot more of a way of understanding, Milton's talk about language of accommodation.
Yeah.
And, in fact, that's how I got to, Milton had a lot greater impact on me when I encountered it for the first time because I'd already read Delaney. So there are other things that work in ways you don't really expect. So.
One thing I find very important is historical context for me because, from my point of view, science fiction paradoxically is very, very much a dialogue with its time. Certainly all the books that I'm interested in. And this is of interest to me as a scientist because you can, any book that's been around a couple of years, you can go back and show how, well, here's what was known in science at that time, and here's how the science in this book is a dialogue with the science of the time. And certainly, for instance, Time Machine, okay, well, they had airships at that time, and the metaphor of time is based on the idea of extrapolating. Well, now we can go up. And is it possible we can actually go in the fourth dimension of time? So there was very much the thought of the airship was a large part of how they thought of time. In the case of Dune, they were just starting to understand the idea of making the desert bloom with water. The technology of that was just coming out, and so you could extrapolate the idea. I mean, that was a big idea, making the desert bloom in the 60s. What they did not know yet was the reverse side of that in terms of desertification, although sort of in later years, Herbert got into that. But the idea of making the desert bloom. Also, all the really mumbo-jumbo stuff about brain science that's in Dune, today that sounds really hokey, but at that time, the brain was such a black box that really you could legitimately propose just about anything. And so you can sort of understand why he proposed the kind of brain science he did, given what was known at the time. And then I can say, well, look, since then, we've learned some of these other things. And I also do that with my own works, because I remember very well what was known when I wrote A Door into Ocean. I remember... for instance, at the time I wrote A Door to Ocean, sexuality was understood as something where animals just used sex for procreation, whereas people did weird, kinky stuff. And so I took that as, it was a sign of being human that you had, say, female-female sex. That was something only humans would do, and that was actually a sign of something special that humans would do it. Well, of course, today we know that animals do everything humans do. So I would tell the students, well, look, even I got this, my work is dated based on that time, and that was necessary for the idea of that book. Today, it is different. So I use the science fiction as a way of explaining that science gets so far in a certain era and then gets farther later. And that's something that science fiction is uniquely able to do.
It actually goes a step further on exactly what we were talking about. One of the contributors to this, Catherine Pandora, who teaches history of science at University of Oklahoma, she's using science fiction, I guess other to get at views of scientists at particular times. How did people see scientists? Is it, the mad scientist?
Right.
What were the views of science and scientists and the views of what people knew at the time?
That is really true. That's especially good for Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because you can look at the different kinds of scientists in Jurassic Park. There's Grant, the physiology-based paleontologist, versus the evil molecular biologists with the recombinant DNA versus the, you know, megabuck corporation guys. And so each of those, you know, and I can, you know, having been in grad school at the time, I can point out and say, yes, those were the kinds of science, and you could have a department that was split between the physiologists and the molecular types. That's really what it was like in that era.
I think that's one of the, I find students pick up on that also very quickly. And, you know, in some ways, fantasy has the benefit of, it's odd because fantasy is fundamentally, this is to oversimplify, but it's nostalgic, right? Much of fantasy looks backwards and creates a world that existed in our imagination. And we imagine, you know, we've seen echoes of it before, sometimes from our childhood, sometimes elsewhere, but it has a tendency to look backwards. Urban fantasy is a little bit different, but even that, I think, is sort of tapping into magics that are from before. And in that sense, it doesn't date to the same degree, since science fiction often relies on sort of being at the cutting edge, and science fiction authors take some pride in being on the cutting edge and getting the science right, which means that in a way they're always going to be sort of dealing with the facts that are in front of them at the time. One of the things that I do is I teach a couple of the, I teach a whole class in one class session in Star Trek, and I give them a couple of the original Star Trek episodes. And, you know, the interesting thing about the original Star Trek is it gets some things kind of right. I mean, there are some things that it gets right, and then there's some things that it gets hideously wrong. And, you know, my students at the very beginning, for example, I teach City on the Edge of Forever, which is the Harlan Ellison episode that maybe wasn't what Harlan wanted, but in any case. So I teach that, and, you know, the beginning of it, the students may have a tendency, I try to prepare them as much as possible, but there's maybe a little bit of snickering at, you know, some of the dated quality of the technology. There's very little snickering by the time you get to the end of the episode, because they've been drawn into what is a spectacular story. And that's one of the things I think is interesting. It goes back to the point I made about the philosophy that they're not expecting, that ultimately, the technology part of it may be dated. The story part, the love part, the decision that Kirk has to make, the line where Spock says he knows Doctor when Kirk stops Dr. McCoy from saving Edith Keeler, that moment, which is a well-acted moment and a well-directed moment, really draws them into the story. And so when I then switch on the lights and start talking to them, they've sobered up quite a bit. And I always find that an interesting transition. And it's indicative of the fact that although, you know, the science itself may date, the best science fiction stories will never have the core of the story's date, regardless of what technology they used or didn't.
And with horror, you know, you're dealing with sort of more another perennial issue with things like Frankenstein. I also did Jekyll and Hyde recently. And so here we have again, or Dr. Faustus, same mm-hmm. thing. Here, there's this desire for forbidden knowledge. And then that raises all kinds of interesting questions. And I mean, on the one hand, you can sort of take it at face value. And the Faust we do, I don't do Goethe's Faust, I do Marlowe's Faust. Mm-hmm. In some ways because it's much shorter, but it's also
better.
It has prosaic moments in it, yeah. And so it's less, because the language is difficult. But you know, Faust isn't a man who can do anything. He can be a doctor, a lawyer, he can do anything. He already knows it all. And he wants more, he overreaches. And when he gets this power, he can't do anything with it but sort of childish, idiotic pranks.
Yeah.
All he can do is make the Pope look dumb.
Yeah.
And throw water on him.
Which is a significant drop from what he wants at the beginning. One of the things, it shows the trajectory of evil, which becomes petty.
He's going to refashion the world, he's going to put oceans here. He's
wall of brass around Germany. And all that. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And instead, he just clowns around with it, and he doesn't do anything significant. And so there's a disappointment there. Then we look at, say, Dr. Frankenstein. Same thing, and they'll see parallels between Frankenstein and his creation, how they're similar. And with Jekyll and Hyde, again, same thing.
Yep.
So this is a kind of micro theme or subsection of the theme. And what I'm getting at, I'm getting at is that, you know, there are all sorts of questions here, not just, you know, why should there be forbidden knowledge? Who does the forbidding? Why? Some students get this, some don't. You know, it's often tricky just getting them to fully apprehend what's happening mm-hmm. in the story or what's meant to be. But once we can get that down, if possible, then you can go on and say, well, who does forbid this? And why? And on what basis? Because it's dangerous? Well, but who knows this? What you're looking at here is not strictly religion, but mores, morals. Societies push back against science.
Right.
You know, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should, necessarily. There's that question. That's that position. Do we adopt this or not? It's like, is it cool, but is it cool for everybody? What are the ramifications?
Right.
And then, no matter what drops into their lap, whether maybe it's an iPad or whatever, you can ask them, well, is this a good thing? In some ways. How is this a bad thing?
Yeah.
Should we do this? Should we do that? And then you can take it to DNA, recombinant bioengineering, Monsanto, you can bring all these issues into it, and things that affect them right now. So you can say, here's literature, but it's not hermetically sealed off from your life and your concerns. It actually affects you very directly. And if you're coming from Zambia, her place where, you know, Monsanto can move in with a pretty heavy hand, and so you're not farming at home anymore, and you're growing our plants our way, they can make an immediate connection to something that really does materially affect them,
right,
with this interesting set of the skill set of critical analysis.
Right.
Well, I was going to say, with respect to Frankenstein, of course, that's one of the central central texts. And at Kenyon, I actually have the advantage that Kenyon is such a literature-obsessed place that I can assume that 90% of the kids have actually read the full original Frankenstein. So I don't even try to teach that. What I do is I show the postmodern Prometheus, the X-Files episode. And that relates the Frankenstein, and they get that completely. That's the second most favorite thing we do. Because that, it very effectively plays off, and it brings the Frankenstein into the current day with the molecular biology. And some of the molecular biology in postmodern Prometheus actually is the same, it's real footage of real Drosophila embryos developing and real Drosophila mutants that we actually show in our introductory biology class. You know, and the question, and it's a very interesting question. I mean, in biology, we make monsters. We make monsters that produce, you know, antennae instead of legs instead of antennae, or legs in the mouth. And they ask the real question, well, why would you make these monsters? And that is something biologists actually do. And so it relates us to those questions, the real questions that biologists have to ask.
Glow-in-the-dark bunnies, too.
There are two other films I found surprisingly useful in recent years. One is the first X-Men film.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that is surprisingly good at, you know, the school for mutants. That whole sequence is really good. And what's amazing is that how many of the X-Men mutations have sort of counterparts in actual human mutations. Okay, like there's the German baby with the double muscle mutation. Okay, so it's surprising how many real-life human mutations you can find sort of counterparts to things in the X-Men. And then, of course, Avatar is fantastic for teaching biology.
One of the nice things is that I think a lot of our students now are coming in because there's been so much, there's such an increase, I think, in sort of popular culture interest in fantasy and science fiction. And you look at movies like Inception or Avatar that we just mentioned, or movies of this kind, to say nothing of the fantasy movies as well, obviously. And what you're doing is getting a lot of students then who have been prepared, even the groups that are not, you know, not there necessarily for science fiction per se, that are at least coming in prepared to understand that there's something about which they might want to learn, and it's not going to come as a total shock to them. So it means I have a little bit less work to do initially to try to, you know, get them to sort of, okay, now this is not just silly. You know, they don't view it, I think, in a lot of ways as silly anymore. Even the ones who are not hardcore sci-fi people do not view it as silly, and I think that's a positive, and it's partly set up by things like the X-Men movies and all these things in popular culture that they can then draw upon. And that's been a big boost for me, and it's a big change from 2003 when I started teaching this course to now. So,
one other thing I kind of wanted to touch on before we take some questions, just because everybody here is also a writer. I mean, one of the things I've experienced, I'm curious about your experience. There's a real energy that I get from the students, and I find,
yep,
as a writer, it's a huge boost. I mean, it's so easy to burn out writing science fiction and fantasy. You know, what is years before stuff comes out. And for me, the energy I get just on being around every semester, around students who are discovering what makes it so exciting for the first time,
yeah,
that energy of, I think makes a keeps me from burning out to a certain extent. But is there you know, an energy or things that you're getting back from?
No question.
In fact, my own writing career has ended up being largely inspired by the students in my class. The book Brain Plague was definitely inspired by the art students. I mean, I would never have written a book about artists, which is basically what Brain Plague is. And the students, so it's like the class inspired that book. And then my most recent book, of course, The Highest Frontier, is really fully about students in the future. And I think that the thing is that the college experience has become the central rite of passage in American society. I mean, people that are going to do anything in life, you know, college, either that or else you're defined by dropping out of it, like Zuckerberg and Bill Gates. But it's defined by, nonetheless, the college is the central thing. And so it's such a privilege, really, to be a part of that. And it has to be intellectually engaging.
I totally agree with that. One of the things that I did a couple of years ago was I was really uncomfortable about doing this, but I had been, as I said, casting around for a book to put in one of those last two slots. And so my chairman finally said, I want you to teach your book. And I was like, I felt weird about teaching my own work, and especially because it wasn't, you know, necessarily science-oriented, it was fantasy-oriented. And I was like, I don't... And he said, listen, the students are going to love the fact they can actually talk to the author. And that was 100% true. I put it up for a vote, and my wife pointed out to me that my students probably weren't going to publicly vote against ruining my book. I was like, I should do secret ballots. But no, I mean, I did it, and it actually worked spectacularly well, precisely for that reason. And I had students come up to me and say, thank you for teaching a book so we could actually talk to you. Now, some of them wanted it, so now we know how to do the book on the exam. And I said, well, that's not, you know, quite what I mean. But most of them really enjoyed the opportunity to sort of peer into the mind of a working writer and someone who is actively shopping more books and someone who is actively working with the community of fantasy and science fiction people. And so not just in my own writing, but in people that I interview for the show, in other sort of contexts that I have, it's given me the opportunity to bring some of that back to my students in my creative writing course, obviously, but also in my fantasy and science fiction course. And so that's been sort of a revelation to me, and my chairman, as is often the case, was right, and was right to sort of tell me, listen, you really ought to teach this, because it's amazing how much they want to get into the minds of the authors and feel that they can't unless they have them even to speak to. And that's been a really eye-opening for me. So yes, it's an incredibly energizing thing for me to teach that class. Yeah.
I'm also very celebrated by the work I've done. First of all, it's extremely exciting when students start to wake up. This is a mandatory class, so they're there, whether they want to be or not. And so when, you know, a lot of them come in kind of glazed, and you know, they especially if they're coming right out of high school, then they're accustomed to teachers sort of phoning it in. So when they start to wake up, when they start to respond, sort of despite themselves, when they start to answer, when they say, well, wait a minute, I think, and they get involved in a discussion, that is galvanizing.
Yep.
And if I can make myself obsolete, this is perfect. If I haven't said anything for 10 minutes, this is perfect. Because they're talking and I'm not.
Yep.
So that is extremely thrilling. And it's not about understanding what I'm saying. It's about thinking about the ideas.
Agreed, yeah.
What you think they
sure.
need. They need some help sometimes, but they can all get there. And as far as my own work, I've never had the audacity to put my own work in front of students. My stuff is pretty abstruse and strange, so I would be hesitant to put it in front of students for a variety of reasons. But I did give a creative writing class, and I did read some of my own stuff. And they said, why don't you read more of your own stuff? I said, well, you didn't ask me. You want me to, I'll do it. I'll bring it every time.
Yeah, I'm kind of on a middle ground there. I mean, it's...
Yeah, it can't be about me.
As a writer and editor, they know me on that. And certainly the writing course, they know that I'm engaged in a field. I don't assign my own writing, but normally I'll bring in three or four other guests during the semester, and I'll read one of their books.
This is what I've done. There are other teachers at the school. There's a woman, Ron Puerto Rico, who writes plays, and she's performed plays, and I had her read her play, and then she came in and talked about it, and this was a complete success. They said, well, why'd you do this? And I said, come in with a question for her or for one of her characters that she can answer. And this, they were all completely involved. And so this was very successful. As far as creative writing goes, I shared some stuff with them, but for the most part, it was about facilitating them, and it was thrilling to see the variety of different approaches. We had someone who was doing very dry sort of Carver-esque stuff. We had someone who was doing like very polished poetry slam type stuff, and a wide range of stuff in between, and they were all throwing ideas around. And it didn't give me, I wrote some stuff from the, you know, point of view of a teacher, because this is not my experience. But it was energizing to see them waking up to different possibilities of what they could do with their fiction, different expressive possibilities. Mm.
At Kenyon, the thing is that so many teachers make students read their stuff. It was very high-powered, scholarly stuff at Kenyon. So they're just relieved. Oh, well, here's a fun thing that the teacher wrote.
They're pretty tough on you. I mean, I had to get, even for the textbook,
tough.
I had to get, you know, go through the whole committee process and get approved to make sure it wasn't.
I think we have some comments.
I'm curious how you, you know, because one of the reasons I don't teach my writing, you know, teach plenty of other people in the class, I'd wonder how, you know, how they would feel about, like, asking questions about it. You know, it kind of, does it become awkward or something? How are they about, you know?
You know, if the teacher's not awkward, the students are okay with it. I think they respond very much to the teacher. Okay.
Yeah, I had concerns about it, but once we did it, I said, well, I might as well, you know, go into it. And the only uncomfortable part was having a few of them ask me to sign their books after, which was not what I wanted, you know. But no, I think I totally agree with Joan. I think it's a matter of not being awkward yourself, and your students respond to that.
First in the middle of
Well, I just, my question comes up because I teach high school English. I teach about the senior fantasy little elective.
Cool.
And I did write a speculative fiction semi-fantasy novel for my MFA program. It's not published, I'm still shopping, but my kids want, they want to read it, and they want to read it as part of the class, and I've always been kind of hesitant to do that, A, because publishing costs and, you know, to get manuscripts and such. But the other thing is, how would you suggest approaching teaching it in a way that kind of like relates with state standards and things like character? Would you talk, go over it from a character-driven perspective or plot, theme?
Well, I mean, two answers to that for me. One is that I taught also in high schools before I started teaching in college, and one of the reasons that I'm happy that I'm able to teach in college is because I don't have to deal with the bloody state standards, which is nothing against the standards themselves, but it's just it takes so long to process all of it and all that. But so I don't have to deal with that part of it. As far as how you teach it, whether it's character or plot driven, a lot of that depends on the book itself in question. But I think if it's sort of right down the middle and you have a choice one way or the other, my experience has been that students almost always react better to a character-driven work, and the reason is because, especially at that level, what high school students are doing is trying to identify fundamentally with the characters in the work. And this is why Twilight, even though it's not a well-written work, Twilight is a work that they connect to because they can relate to the characters involved in that story. And whatever we may say about the relative quality of it, there's no question that it's very good at putting forward characters that kids of that age, you know, can kind of identify with. And so, given a choice between the two, I would approach it from a character-driven perspective. I think you will seldom find, if you do it the right way, that that it won't go over well, just given my experience, because I was very nervous about the whole process before I started teaching it, and ultimately, as I say, they really sort of picked up on some of the nuances of the book that I hadn't even noticed, and they were grateful to be able to discuss those nuances with me rather than sort of the faceless person in print on the page,
exactly.
Which is so much of their experience. 99.9% of the time, at least at my university, they're not going to get to know directly the people who wrote this work. So I recommend it if you can do it, and character plot, I would go in the character direction if the book calls for it.
And we do spend a lot of time discussing like the sub-creative process, like we do the never-ending story.
Yeah, yeah.
And especially look at the second half of the book from the perspective of the creator, and they're like, well, Ms. Rainville, you wrote a book, what was it like?
Yeah, that's a good time, yeah.
Can we read your book? Can you teach your book? I'm like, I don't know, that feels really weird.
I have two practical suggestions. Mm-hmm. First of all, if you're talking about expense, no, the kids, they all have computers now. So if you make an e-version, you can convert it to Kindle even. That's an easy way to go.
Publisher gets it.
And well,
does that cause problems?
Not necessarily. No.
It's online.
Well,
I think it depends on whether or not you grant exclusive rights.
Also, you know, you can also upload it as a PDF and just do it like that.
That's right.
And
PDF is fine.
It's different from putting it on your website or something.
Okay. You know, the publishers have to deal. I mean, all my works are pirated out there.
Yeah.
If you want to buy my everything I ever wrote, plus 100 other science fiction writers, all on one disc, it's up there on eBay. You know, that is such a red herring.
Yeah.
The second thing I was going to suggest about the standards, you know, what I did with The Door to Ocean is I wrote my own study guide on my website. So you can write your own study guide and then have it address each of the standards. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then it's
yeah,
there.
Have somebody else look at it. Have someone else who knows those standards look it over
right.
And check it. And then they can document that you found someone who knows something about this, mm-hmm. who's in some sort of authority, and they can give you an email or a letter that you can then show.
Yeah.
So if anybody ever calls you on this, you're
fine. The other thing is, even if you're not directly using, I mean, indirectly using it is great. And then being able to say, you know, here's how I encountered this particular plot problem that you're running into in the story, here's how I solved it, here's how I dealt with this.
Right.
It personalizes it in a way, even if they aren't reading the whole book, and some will resent it, embarrassed to read it, but having you be able to bring in examples from your own writing in the class is a very powerful thing.
Yep.
Another thing, show them the early versions with all the scribbles and edits.
Oh, yeah.
That's the thing that the students love, is because they're amazed. You know, they think that great work, you know, just springs like out of the forehead of Zeus.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it is enlightening to them to see that, you know, where you had to do all the edits.
Yeah.
I think we have time for one question.
I just taught my first science fiction college class this last term, and it was a mind-boggling experience for me. It's the best teaching experience I've ever had. And I'm in a writing group with Jim Kelly, and Jim looked up my syllabus online. So I see you teaching my dinosaur story.
Mm-hmm.
Would you be interested in having me Skype with your
yes,
students?
Yes, right. That's wonderful.
And I said, well, how about if we pay you and you come down? So Jim came and talked to me, and they had a wonderful time interrogating him about the genesis of that story and its relationship with the cold equation. It was really very interesting conversation. And then as I'm having lunch with Jim after the thing, I almost don't even want to tell you guys this because I kind of want to keep to myself, but Jim said, you know, if you were to offer science fiction writers $100 a pop to Skype with your students for a day, you could probably have the author of half the stories in your course actually addressing your students via the internet each time. And so the experience of having the direct access to the author. Although, as I say it that way, it occurs to me that it's also good for them to, at the same time, have the experience of not having access to
you need a certain amount of it.
Yeah,
and I think it's great to get that example of these are real people. You know, it's something we do for a living. It's something we work at. It is a craft. You need a certain distance from a lot of stories, too, though. I mean, I love having, you know, three or four a semester. When I teach in the summer, I teach the science fiction course online. And there I'm not limited to, you know, who I can talk into coming to visit for a few days during leaf season or whatever, and then come in and talk to my classes and then do a reading at the co-op. I can do, you know, anybody who's got an email account, and they'll come in and join the discussions and things. So I can bring in more. But they love having a relationship with the writer and feeling like they've gotten that, gotten to ask it. But I think there is a point where it gets to be too much.
Yeah, well, a little difference along the way.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, you don't get broadband in cemeteries. And if you do, it doesn't do much good. So if your authors are all dead, it's not so. But yeah, there is going to be reading people they don't know.
Yeah.
So, but just having had access even to one writer, they see the process and then they can sort of reverse engineer that for
Skype is wonderful for that. And I agree that one is enough, you know. But I strongly recommend the Skype thing. It's just like having a person in the classroom with the students. And now, another thing that can be interesting is Second Life, if you've ever used Second Life. The advantage of Second Life is that everybody shows up as an avatar, and they can be more anonymous and less inhibited.
Mm-hmm.
So I taught a class on for a teacher at Oral Roberts University, where we're talking about inhibition. And he said it was wonderful because everybody showed up as, you know, a cat or a dinosaur, and we could talk about things.
They teach in a party school. I'm not really sure I want them any, you know, less inhibited in the classroom. I find out way more than I want to know about my students as it is. So, okay, I think, yeah.
Do
any of you have a particular work that the idea fascinates you but it didn't fit in your theme, but you'd love to teach it somewhere sometime? Or you couldn't teach it because you know when we approved where you are now, but you'd love to teach it sometime?
Mac and Blackwood, people like that, stories like The White People, Breakup, and, you know, these are very important in the tradition of weird fiction, but they are not really available to, or Aikman would be another example. They're very important in the tradition, they're major figures, but they're a little too difficult or too trey, or they depend on a certain sensibility that is largely not available to the students, and I don't know how to reverse engineer that. So, yeah, that would be the sort of thing I would
like. To me, it's more an issue of length. I think it's more you know, being able to fit it in. I mean, my university would approve whatever I wanted to teach in the course. They're very good about that. But you know, but there's work that I would love to get in for the fantasy section of this course that I'm teaching. I would love to teach a book by John Myers called Silverlock, which ties in an enormous amount of fantasy work that they're going to be reading anyway. But I can't do it because it's too long, it's just not enough for them to be able to kind of get their heads around. I do almost a novel a week with them, so it's pretty ambitious as it is, and I have to make it short novel. You know, like it has to be short enough for it to work. And the largest book, probably the longest book I do on the science fiction side, is Ender's Game. And even that I have to split into two classes to get through it. So it's more of sort of a, you know, a length issue that has to be done.
Red Mars. I've taught Red Mars. And it's wonderful. It's a little too long.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I run into with the Brin sometimes. You have to spend a lot of time on it, and I don't always have enough class time, I need them to get it,
hopefully,
to be able to teach it. And some classes do, and some classes don't. There's always that, you know, their time on teaching my favorite stories, and it takes sometimes a while to get past that. Some classes will get it, and will love it as much as you do. Some classes, that, you know, your four or five stories that day, and the one you that was really your favorite, they really don't talk about that much.
Yep.
It didn't click with them the same way. And some other story that you may not have liked nearly as much, they're dying to talk about.
That's
hard sometimes.
But I think you need to be able to go, as a professor or a teacher, you need to be able to go towards that ambiguity or difficulty that they're having and not shy away from it. If they're not responding well, why not? And rather than just saying, you know, oh my God, this is a dismal failure, you know, going directly after why it's not resonating with them can often be as instructive as, you know, well, we all love this, well, wonderful, we all love this together. In some ways, the times when the students don't necessarily jive with what your understanding of the work was, that can be as productive or more productive than everyone loves this thing equally. So,
sometimes think they hate it. You get the evaluations later.
This was the best, but yeah.
It took 6 weeks later to click.
Yeah.
Can you give some examples? I'd just be really curious to, like, can you talk about what they hated and what they loved?
People look at the, they hated, and like you said, and then later they loved in the evaluation.
We're actually out of time. So,
well, we can talk about that.
I'll give you one quick one. On the fantasy side, The Last Unicorn. The Last Unicorn, a lot of my students started out really disliking, and by that they actually came to like it, a lot of them. Not all of them, but a lot of them. That's one quick example. So.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.